Hello, everybody. This week we have a guest all the way from India, Dr. Sivakami, and I was honored to be able to speak with her. Dr. Sivakami has her master's and PhD in population studies and has had numerous academic appointments, grants. She's on multiple boards. She is one busy lady, and we will get into that in this episode. Dr. Sivakami's work broadly focuses on demography, gender, and health. She was originally trained as a quantitative researcher, but has transitioned into including and conducting qualitative research in most of her studies, and now resonates most with a mixed methodology approach to research. There's some really great takeaways from this episode, including the path to a PhD and how research interests can ebb and flow and change over the course of not only the process of getting a PhD, but once you start your career with it. And we also talked about how the commitments of an academic career interplay with things outside of just your job, like motherhood or being involved in outside organizations. If it's your first time with us, I'm so happy you're here. We are a student-run podcast called From the Front Row that talks about major issues in public health and how they are relevant to anyone both in and outside of the field of public health. So without further ado, Dr. Sivakami. We are honored to have you on the podcast today. Could you start by introducing yourself?
Yeah, thank you, Lavin, for having me here. And I'm absolutely, absolutely delighted to be doing this. I am Sivakami. I'm a professor at the Tata Institute of Social Science in India, which is located in Mumbai. And we are one of the premier social science institute in India. And wow. I'm here as a global public health visiting scholar. And I'm honored to be here with that invitation, which is actually kind of helping me kind of explore the possibilities for future work with CPH colleagues, and also helping conduct one of the PhD student, Priyanka, her doctoral defense.
Yeah. So, how long are you here for?
I have been here for a week now. So now I go from here to Atlanta to visit Emory University for a day. And then a day with my friend, then I'll fly back to India.
Okay. Are you looking forward to going back home?
Yes, of course. I have a daughter. I have a small daughter. So of course I'm looking forward to
going back. Oh, sweet.
Yeah, because that is the reason why I hesitated even to come here when Priyanka and Dr. Rima asked me whether I could visit here as a visitor. I was very hesitant because I didn't want to leave my daughter behind. But then the way that Priyanka and Rima asked me, and which kind of motivated me, okay, why not? And I've not been in the past for such a long time. And I've been working with these colleagues now for the last 3.5 years almost. So then I thought, okay, why not? I accept the invitation and honor that and explore the possibility of kind of being here so that I could understand how things work here. Yeah. And also establish a future collaboration. It's always good to be in person to do a future collaborations if one is thinking about.
I'm so excited
to be also be part of Priyanka's as a, one of the committee member.
That is great. Well, we were so honored to have you here. You have a very extensive background in demographic research. How has your journey unfolded from your early days at university?
Right. Thank you, Levin. Actually, when I saw this question, honestly, it kind of made me think through my life like over for a long time, right?
Exactly.
One has not really thought through about that. So it really helped me reflect about that. So just to give you a little bit of context, where I come from, what kind of education that I have, so set the tone to understand where I am currently. My graduation and PhD was from one of the state universities in Tamil Nadu. It is actually a southern state in India. I considered switching my stream from chemistry to social science was the turning point in my life. I did undergraduates in chemistry. Then from there, I kind of moved to social science, studying the population science and demography. So that was like a turning point for me. You know, coming from a small, tiny village in one of the southern state to a city called Coimbatore for my graduation and PhD was a life-changing event for me.
I'm sure.
Phase for me. And for me to have that change from a small, very small village, very tiny village, and even today we don't have many PhDs. There is only one person after me who have done PhD very recently. And there were three people I would kind of credit my entire journey towards academics. One is there are two members from my family. My mother and my uncle, my father's brother, were very keen in educating me in times and surroundings where girls' education was viewed only from the marriage perspective. And I come from a generation and cohort where girls were educated in my village and my community for a better marriage prospect. But I mean, I was fortunate to have a mother who never went to school. So she always told me that I never went near school, neither for a rain nor for a sunshade. So you can study as much as you want. Think that kind of always stuck in my head. And I wanted to pursue study as much as I wanted. And PhD was one of the highest degree that I could pursue. So when I finished my undergraduation, and I went for this graduation to the city, and I was fortunate to work with a professor who was educated in US, and I was very, very fond of wanting to work with him. And when I finished my graduation, and he kind of asked me whether I would like to do PhD with him, which really changed my life. I must say that 360 degrees. Had that not happened, probably I'm not here talking to you in this podcast. I had a lot of difficulty in terms of language as I studied in a vernacular medium for most part of my education until I moved to graduation. But working with my supervisor really helped me shape my language and also my worldview about everything. I would say everything, not just my academics, but everything. And I always say that to my students now. I think for me, it's a time for me to pay it forward. I am standing on a platform that my guide, Professor P.M. Kulkarni, a well-known demographer in India, gave. And I owe my entire career to three people, two from my family, which is my mom and my uncle, and the third one is my supervisor. Without my family and my supervisor, I would not have made it to the place that I am in TISS as a professor, and I would not have been made it to Iowa and doing this podcast with you. So that's the kind of journey that I have had till my PhD. So once I finished my PhD, I got an offer within a couple of months from my PhD to an organization called Institute for Social and Economic Change, where I worked for almost a decade, 9.5 years I worked there. While doing demography back in Coimbatore, I did not study beyond demography. But my first job in an organization where I was exposed to there are other fields in the social science. I literally embraced that opportunity to learn and shape my thinking. And around this period that I was very, very early on in my career, there were a couple of friends who helped me navigate in my first job. I was a 27-year-old who got a job as an assistant professor, and I went there. I was still not moved out from my student life, but some of these friends really helped me. So I would say that being open to learning new things and surrounding yourself with supportive people is critical in our life. And so till then, I mean, I think this was till 2010. 2010, I moved to Tata Institute of Social Science for a parallel position. By then, I was an associate professor in my earlier organization in Bangalore, which is again a South Indian research institute. When I had this opportunity moved to 2010, I was honestly, I must admit that very unsure whether I was making the right decision because I was already an associate professor and I was moving for a same parallel position to an organization which was taking me further away from my family. And I thought about it, but I made that bold decision to move. I don't know what made me to move. I think basically I was looking for probably a better opportunity, better career taking off. And today, if you ask me, that was one of the best decision in my career, and I've not looked back. And moving to TISS was the really one of my life changing in my entire career. However, I must admit that the initial days were a bit scary and nerve-wracking. The reason why I say it was a bit scary and nerve-wracking, I moved from an organization where I used to teach PhD students. In my class, there will be one or two demography or population study PhD students, or maximum 10 PhD students, to an organization where my first class of teaching for graduate students were 120 in my class.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I was standing in this podium for my first class, and I can't tell you, my blood was reaching up to my head. And that was my first class. So it was a really a nerve-wracking experience. But once I got past that initial months, and I very soon realized that I love teaching and it came very natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
I soon also realized that I loved shaping students for their research. And working alongside students and mentoring is what makes me thrive at this stage in my career. So
yeah.
That's kind of sums up from my graduation to what I do today. Today, I have an opportunity to mentor several PhD students and dozens of master's students. And I teach such big classes, and it's no longer nerve-wracking. But so that's it.
Well,
That's
what an eloquent way to describe your journey. And even though I think obviously you're from India, I think a lot of American academic students relate to that same thing of having mentors in their life that help to determine their path and being uncertain if they want to, you know, move away from their family. I think that there's a lot more commonality amongst the two systems than maybe we would originally believe. Could you elaborate on the significance of your research titled Mothers' Work Participation in Child Health, a Study in Poor Localities in Tamil Nadu, India? And what were the key findings and implications in that research?
Great. Frankly, you made me think about the work that I did 20 years ago. This was my PhD work.
Really?
Yes.
Making you think back.
I must say that I enjoyed every bit of this work.
Mm-hmm.
Today, one has so many responsibility as a faculty, as a mentor for research students, as you have your family, child, and other care activities that you do. But back then, when I did my PhD, all I did was study and do work.
Actually. Exactly.
I literally studied. But this PhD work, I learned so many valuable lessons during this period. Not just in my research, but also in general about the value of research, what research can contribute to shaping policies and how to conduct ethical research and
mm-hmm.
how to be a better human being, in fact. I mean, that was one thing I learned from my guide. And
yeah.
Today people tell me, my students tell me that, ma'am, you are inspiring for us and we look up to you. And I keep wondering that I'm not doing anything so different and I'm doing exactly what my guide did probably 23 years ago for me to kind of lift me up and help me shape who I am today. So coming to the work that I did, when I did this work, there were two schools of thought on the impact of mothers' work participation on child health. One school of thought was that mothers' work positively influenced child health, as mothers who are working would have better income at their disposal and have relatively better autonomy, and there is hence a positive outcome. So that's one school of thought.
Yeah.
The other school of thought was, using the large-scale studies, large-scale data, was that mothers' work had a negative impact on child mortality and health,
mm-hmm.
because often mothers who are working would have a less time at their disposal, hence they may neglect their child. So that was the kind of argument, the two schools of thought. And I was very intrigued by this, though very, very naively in those days. I must say that it was not so consciously I was kind of intrigued. I was so naive in research, but then I was definitely intrigued by the two school of thought.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, I wanted to understand in depth the pathways in which mothers work participation on child health using a primary data. So I went on to collect information on mothers' work participation on child health from a very resource-poor setting in India. Using my extensive literature during that process, what I found was mother's time is the key factor here, not just the autonomy or the income that she is earning, but mother's time at her disposal is one of the key factors that was often measured in the literature around women's work and child health was total time spent on child care. That is how much time mother is able to spend on child care. What I did was, I think I am very proud to say that what I did, that I broke that into two major categories, that mother's time on basic child care activities and other child care activities like playing with children, etc. So interestingly enough, when I did my analysis and further research, I found out that there was not so much difference between mother's time on child care when it comes to basic activities, irrespective of her work status. It is the time that's spent on extra activities like playing or teaching the children that gets affected when mother takes up an employment. This is very important to understand, especially for women from poor household, as mothers need to take up these jobs. There is no choice other than taking up this choice. The narrative of all mothers' work affect negatively will have serious consequences for these mothers. Hence, I would say it's important to look beyond what is conventionally measured or what is conventionally done, so that we could contribute to the broader knowledge which would actually kind of help shape the lives of many people. That's what I would think the contribution that I made 25 years ago, probably.
Well, that seems like a pretty significant contribution. Did that impact the way that you think about being a mother now?
Clearly, I always tell people that I am a bad mother if I would have not had my job. I would be a bad professor if I would not have had a daughter.
Love
And
that.
I need to have both of these to thrive in both these locations. I'm not saying that I'm able to break the ceilings and able to balance all of this or both of these roles that I have. There are times I have had to neglect my work to take care of my daughter. And there are other times I had to neglect her needs to thrive or deliver in my work. But having had my daughter for the last 10 years, I can safely, comfortably say that it's a challenging, but I need to have both of these identity for me to thrive in both these locations.
That's really hopeful for any individuals that want a family, because I don't know that that's always the narrative. So it's great to hear that from someone who's been so successful.
Thank you.
You've transitioned from primarily quantitative research to incorporating many qualitative methods, and now you have a more mixed methodology approach in your research. How has this evolution changed your perspective on studying health, gender, and demographics?
Thank you for that question, Levin. I've always asked this question because my training initially primarily was in quantitative methods as a demographer and population scientist. My primary training and initial work as an early career researcher for about 10 years, mainly I used quantitative approach to look at any of the public health issue or child health issue or any of the women's health issue, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I'm not at all discounting that. I thoroughly enjoyed and I continue to enjoy even today. However, when I moved to my current organization, which is Tata Institute of Social Science, my first research grant from Indian Council of Medical Research, which is one of the government body which funds very many critical studies, needed to use a mixed methodology approach. This was to understand migrants' health in Mumbai. So this gave me a great opportunity to learn, if not the entire complexity of the qualitative methods, at least to use in that particular project for that period. So I kind of took some training on qualitative methods. And I also read up a lot of research articles and papers which have used qualitative research methods, which helped me to gain confidence to use both of these methods for this particular project. When I did that project, and I realized that I thoroughly enjoyed bringing these two methods and what these two methods can offer to each other. Honestly, clearly, these two methods can actually offer and complement so much to each other. For example, using quantitative methods, we are able to measure the magnitude, how big the problem is. So in our project, we were able to understand migrants' health situations and for not and the reasons for not utilizing healthcare for among the migrants. But reasons for not utilizing healthcare among the migrants, we use the qualitative methods like in-depth interview and FGDs to understand in depth and in a more broader, I would say, depth knowledge. That's when I realized how these methods can perfectly complement each other to understand people's health and well-being beautifully. Since then, somehow I've been fortunate. I've been consciously using both these methods in almost all my funded research. So quantitative methods helps us understand the macro picture, especially for the policy, or if you have to impress the policymakers to listen to you, you need to tell them that how big this problem is. But the other one, qualitative methods, helps us to understand the depth, why you see the differences that you see in that macro pictures. So both of these methods can perfectly complement each other. And I think as researchers, I would always encourage all young researchers to make use of that so that we could benefit from both of these methods.
What a great explanation of quantitative versus qualitative and how they can work together. That was good. We've already kind of established that you are a very busy lady. You have lots of jobs, but as an academic editor at the PLOS, Global Public Health, and a member of the editorial board for the BMC Women's Midlife Health, could you share some of your insights into the current trends and challenges in these fields?
I'm glad you asked this question because, one of the challenges people from Global South, especially the researchers from Global South, face is the publication costs for many of these well-reputed journals, whether it is PLOS, Global Public Health, or Lancet, or PLOS One, which are the top journals in our public health and health field. So there are the publishing in these journals are very expensive for people from Global South, as our universities do not have that kind of funding support for publications. Unlike of, see, I work with many of the colleagues from Global North. So I know that many of these organizations have tie-up with these established journals where the articles get published. They get support from their organizations for the processing fees. But unfortunately, people from Global South like me and other researchers, we don't have that kind of, we're not that privileged and fortunate to have that opportunity. And that's where journal like PLOS Global Public Health comes in handy, because we see many, many great articles from Global South that are of such good quality. So being in the academic board for the sexual and reproductive health is being kind of really rewarding, because I know how hard it is to publish in some of these established journals. But here is an opportunity I could help several colleagues from Global South. And PLOS Global Public Health is one of the journal which encourages and provides opportunity for Global South people with less cost, or sometimes with funding support, full funding support.
That's great.
Yeah, so
So
for me,
then,
that's very, very, very important thing.
is that journal primarily with contributors from the Global South, or is it open to anyone?
It's open to everybody. It's open to everybody, but we do see very many scholarly work coming there, because we know that if your paper is getting accepted, we could ask for the publication fee being waived off. And I'm aware of many situations where the publication's fee being waived off from people from the Global South.
That's really important for diversity, especially in research. We want to be able to hear
Yes.
everybody's voices. You're also involved in various committees, including the Ethics Committee at ICMR and IRRH, and as an internal committee member under the Sexual Harassment of Women at Workplace Act 2013, which indicates a commitment to ethical practices and gender equality, both in your personal life and in your work. How do you navigate responsibilities outside of your academic career, such as these, alongside with your academic pursuits?
That's a very good question again. I must say that, because any additional responsibility outside your teaching and research involves time. So being in this committee is a huge responsibility, not just from the time spent perspective, but it is also from the way that you spend the time here. So often, you being in this committee, the time spent in this committee is not considered for your promotions, and one does not see a tangible benefits being in this committee.
Yeah.
But I feel that it's my responsibility to contribute to the development of an organization, especially at this level that I am in. I'm already a kind of a senior researcher. I do feel that, yes, it's going to take a lot of our time, but it is also a responsibility to build good ethical practices, safe environment for people who are working in the organizations. So I believe that however it takes, we must contribute to those overall development of organizations. But I understand where the question is coming from. And obviously, it's going to take huge time for you from your research and your teaching away. No doubt, I do have challenges in being in this committee because some of these committees take up time. For example, if you are part of the prevention of sexual harassment of workplace, those kind of committees, you do have to inquire a number of times. And oftentimes, these are outside your office hours. So it is a huge responsibility. But I think let's not shy away from taking up this responsibility, especially at our level. I can understand colleagues who are in the early career kind of straddling between these committees and the publications and teachings. But at least at our level, we must actually contribute to this for the overall development of the committee. And it also talks about who you are as a person. For example,
Absolutely.
For me, I have experienced so many gendered challenges while growing up and in my initial jobs and continue to face. I mean, as a woman, you continue to face a lot of challenges, both at your work and at your other lives. So I think for me, this is a platform that I could make better for somebody else navigating those challenges. So that's a standpoint that I come when it comes to some of these committees. And I'm absolutely, I do recognize that it takes up time, but I do want to do that as a person.
Yeah.
I think that really helps me to see who I am actually.
I hope that many of us want to leave our communities in a better shape than we found them. Clearly, you are doing that, especially for women that follow you.
You've
also received many research grants from a multitude of prestigious organizations. How do these collaborations contribute to advancing your research goals? And then could you highlight any particularly impactful projects that have been funded by grants?
This is my absolutely favorite question.
Good.
See, I love working with projects that involve both national and international collaborations. So both these national and international collaborations helps you share and benefit from cross-cultural research experiences and also the cross-cultural organizational experiences. And you would gain these experiences only through collaborative projects. Like, for example, I've had a number of projects both within India. I've collaborated with colleagues and also I've collaborated outside. I'm conscious of the fact that sharing knowledge in such collaborative projects can do wonders and enhance our appetite for new knowledge. I think, like, for example, even me being here in Iowa this time, clearly, I can see that it's going to lend itself for future work. Colleagues I've been meeting the last 1 week, and everybody, I think we've always found some common path to take it forward. These projects can really help you thrive, challenge yourself, and also thrive in your work. So I've done multiple projects over the years collaboratively. Of all the projects, if you ask me to reflect on which is that one project that I would kind of put it on the top. The one of the project that I kind of did way back in 2015 and 16 with colleagues from Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a colleague, and today I can safely call as a friend. It's Professor Penelope Howard. And this project on mental hygiene management, which is it is one of the pet topic and my all-time favorite topic for almost a decade now.
Yeah.
This was a funding support from UNICEF way back in 2015 and 16. Although this project is over within a year and almost 10 years ago, still continue to work together on MHM issues globally and nationally.
Mm-hmm.
Our relationship during this project led to long-standing partnership with these colleagues, and we continue to write and publish even today. Through this project, along with colleagues in UNICEF India, we also helped shape national guideline on menstrual hygiene management way back in 2015.
Wow.
Yeah, the work from this project and my subsequent work on MHM has also helped me to become an expert on MHM in several national and international platforms. Just to share with you, this was also one of the projects which brought me here. The work that I've done on menstrual hygiene brought me here as a global health expert to CPH, because Priyanka asked me way back 3.5 years ago, knowing my work on menstrual hygiene management, mm-hmm. whether I could be in her doctoral committee as one of the main supervisor.
Is menstrual hygiene management different, would you say, in India versus the US?
Clearly.
Okay.
Clearly. So I gave a talk on last Tuesday on menstrual hygiene, India's story of menstrual hygiene. So even today, roughly about 30 to 40% of young women do not use hygienic menstrual products in India.
Wow.
And we have improved a lot. I'm not saying that we have not improved. For example, the time that I've started this work way back in 15 to now, we have phenomenally leaps and bounds we have improved.
Mm-hmm.
For example, those days, it was never been on government agenda. It was never been considered as a public health agenda. But mm-hmm. today in India, we have a very dedicated mental hygiene program. And we are also, as we speak, we are actually talking about bringing out a national menstrual hygiene policy. So we have done a huge, huge, tremendously improving over the years.
That's great.
But we still have a long way to go. We still have, for example, there are intersectional issues in among the menstrual hygiene management. For example, we don't know so much about people with disability, what is their mm-hmm. experiences. We barely have few experiences. And we don't know sex workers, what is their menstrual hygiene experiences. And women at workplace, and women who are in the later part of their life cycle approach, later part. We tend to know more about the adolescent girls and young women, but there are also other women who navigate menstruation and heavy bleeding and other complications associated with menstruation in later part of their life. So I don't think menstrual hygiene is that major issue in general, but possibly for a group of individuals in US, it could be an issue.
That's a really great point. Thank you for indulging that side question.
Yeah, no problem.
And I just have one question left and then we can wrap it up. Winning the Linnaeus Palme Fellowship and the Global Spotlight International Research Seed Grant speaks volumes about your international recognition. How have these experiences influenced your approach to research? And you kind of already touched on this, but collaboration on the global scale.
Okay, I will talk about this in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, this helps build your confidence, especially when you are in a young and early career researcher. Any recognition you get nationally and outside and internationally, it boosts your recognition right away, right? Such recognition and such collaborations also often leads to further collaborations, both nationally and internationally.
Yeah.
For example, even the invitation to come to Iowa and CPH as a Global Health Visiting Scholar is an excellent recognition for the good work one is doing. So when I agreed to be on Priyanka's committee, I never knew that such an opportunity would come in the future. When she approached me, I could not say no for not being in her committee, because she worked on my favorite topic, which is on menstrual hygiene, and a group where we have no evidence in India, which is trans men's menstrual hygiene experience.
Yes.
However, this visit helped me also establish connections with several other colleagues in CPH. And that's what these recognitions and awards help. So often these recognitions lead you to gain confidence, especially when you are an early career researcher and mid-career researcher. And but then it also lends itself for a future larger collaboration, which really kind of takes up your career in a different directions and makes you learn new things. So what I would say in short, for everyone, appreciation and recognitions are essential to thrive in our work, and which often lends ourselves to establish a larger collaboration and participate in international forums and also develop our career paths differently and navigate different challenges. So that's why the recognition and collaborations are always important.
Thanks for summarizing that. That was great. And thank you for being on the podcast. You had so much great wisdom to share, and I hope everyone that listens found a few takeaways. Thank you so much, Dr. Sivakami. We appreciated you sharing.
Thank you so much. I mean, it was really wonderful. You made me reflect about my journey so far. So that's a nice way to sum up my trip here. Thank you so
We
much.
love to hear it.
That's it for our episode this week. Thank you to Dr. Sivakami for joining me today. This episode was hosted and written by Lauren Lavin and edited and produced by Lauren Lavin. You can learn more about the University of Iowa College of Public Health on Facebook. Our podcast is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help support the podcast, please share it with your colleagues, friends, or anyone interested in public health. Have a suggestion for our team? You can reach us at cph-gradambassador@uiowa.edu. This episode was brought to you by the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Until next week, stay healthy, stay curious, and take care.